This chapter was taken from the Food and Feelings Workbook, written by Karen R. Koenig. Chapter 3, titled Feelings, Not Food. Feelings, not food. I'd rather suck on a lemon. Because feelings are so complicated and we're so poorly schooled in handling them, it's easy to see why anyone might get food and feelings confused. However, if you consistently binge or reject food when you're upset rather than let your feelings flow, you're not meeting your body's needs for nourishment and pleasure or your heart's need to experience its wisdom. Very possibly you don't even realize that your eating behaviors are being driven by internal discomfort. In fact, you may be so out of touch with your emotions that you have no idea they even exist, simmering below the surface of consciousness. They're only a heartbeat away, but if you constantly tune them out, they might as well be on the moon. Remember, feelings are the portal to your inner world, the key to your deepest yearnings and desires, the compass that guides you through life. Focus in on feelings as sharply you do on food and weight obsessions, maybe even half as sharply, and you'll get a vital information that will move you towards health and authentic happiness. This may seem like a tall order to someone who's depended on dysfunctional eating to quell emotional pain. Yet, there's no other way. Food is food, and feelings are feelings, and never the twain shall meet. If you're tired of searching in supermarkets and restaurants for the cure to what ails you, if you're sick of obsessing about fats and calories or the magic number on the bathroom scale, it's time to find a better way to manage your emotions. What is the connection between feeding and feeling? One of the major reasons we focus on food when we're in distress is the powerful primitive connection that exists between feeding and feeling. It's no accident that food becomes an issue when emotional dander starts to fly. If you take a closer look at your earliest years on Earth, you'll see that you come by an appetite effect response quite naturally. Here's what happens. Nothing is more critical for an infant than being fed. At best, a poorly nourished child will suffer malnutrition. At worst, it'll starve to death. An effective parent takes the utmost care of feeding an infant. The bottle must be heated to the right temperature. The baby must be held at a correct angle. The feeding must stop if the baby falls asleep or has had enough. Moreover, the feeling and emotional bonding that occurs between parent and child during feeding is nearly as crucial as the receipt of adequate nourishment. An innate physical need gets expressed through closeness. Think how most of us like to hold hands, hug, cuddle, fondle, and have sex. Touch often reaches our hidden wounds and comforts us in a way that words simply cannot. Additionally, on a metaphysical level, touch makes us feel less alone in this vast and mysterious universe, offering reassurance that there is someone close by. As infants, we suffer from two mystifying and terrifying human conditions. We're often hungry, and we hate being left alone for long. Being fed while we're held is something close to divine. For babies, it just doesn't get any better. Sometimes for grown-ups, too. That's why we're feeling and feeding first intersect or fuse. When we're lovingly held while receiving nourishment, two of our most urgent needs are gratified at once. Hence, most of us begin to associate feeding with safety, security, closeness, pleasure, and comfort. From then on, the two are forever inextricably intertwined, marriage for better or worse. Moreover, milk, our first meal, is a tasty source of pleasure in its own right, containing tryptophan. Milk produces a relaxing response. Even if we weren't cradled in loving arms as we drank, we couldn't help but make a deliriously delightful, unconscious connection to being fed and a contented drowsiness. And, forever after, this is one of the unconscious attractions that food has for us, the blissful tranquility we felt as infants, something we still at times achingly long for. Some babies, however, are not so fortunate. Their parents are out of sync with their feeding needs, or fail utterly to meet them. Infants who remain hungry for too long may associate hunger with extreme emotional discomfort and distress. Or they may be handled roughly when fed, a bottle shoved into their tiny mouth and forced to drink until it's all gone, whether they're full or not. Some babies receive little, if any, positive body contact when fed. In such cases, feeding and feeling are still coupled together, but in a cruel way. Nourishment is associated with punishment and or literal intrusion, and food may eventually be perceived as discomforting. It's essential to understand this initial potential connection between feeding and feeling, especially if you're the kind of disordered eater that comes down really hard on yourself. You think there's something critically wrong with you, that you're defective, weird, weak, unbalanced, or depraved because of the intense, overwhelming urgency or repulsion you feel towards food. Understanding this primitive association makes it easier to suspend judgment after your next binge, or when all you've been eating all day is a lettuce leaf. The key is to recognize that you're biologically programmed to focus on food when under stress. This association is hardwired, so please have some compassion for yourself. The link goes far beyond infancy, however. Even if it wasn't the case in your particular family, in our culture, and most, food is special and often confers specialness. Parents may serve frozen dinners every night, but when company rings the bell, they generally make an extra effort to serve a tasty and tasteful meal. Food is associated with times of emotion, candy for Valentine's Day, homemade cookies for a sick friend, a decorative wedding or birthday cake, candy canes hung on a Christmas tree, chocolate coins for Chanukka, an array of dishes on the dining room table after a funeral, and a traditional turkey that brings family home for Thanksgiving. Everywhere we turn, food is a smack in the middle of occasions that tug at our heartstrings. In the best of worlds, our parents weren't disordered eaters or obsessed about weight and didn't use a spoon or a scale to keep their inner world from exploding. Instead, they validated our feelings, spent just the right amount of time soothing us, and handled their own feelings competently. They offered us goodies from time to time when we were unhappy, but gave us the message loud and clear that food is the appropriate response to physical hunger, and that friends and family are there for sympathy and support. The sad truth is, I've only met a handful of people who've had parents this insightful, thoughtful, sensitive, and emotionally intelligent. If you weren't raised in the best of worlds, but like many of us, grew up in our own little world, your appetite and emotions connection may be faulty. You may use food to feel better, to avoid feeling worse, or to feel nothing at all. If you fixate on weight and food to avoid emotional wounds, rather than turn to people for support, you have the whole process backwards. If you want to end disordered eating, you'll have to break the link between feelings and food. This is a formidable, arduous task because this connection is hardwired and because of the considerable reinforcement we receive about using food as an emotional band-aid. However, take heart. This link can be broken. Through hard work, you can reprogram yourself to form a positive, healthy relationship with your heart and your hunger. I know you can succeed because I've done it myself and helped scores of others do it. But first, you have to learn everything you can about your emotions. And I mean everything. Stop and feel. How do you feel about your food problem now that you understand the powerful biological connection between food and feeling? You can stop and pause to reflect on this question. Practice exercise. Self-comfort. The purpose of this exercise is to learn to physically self-soothe. And the rationale is that self-soothing is a necessary skill in regulating emotions, a combination of positive self-talk and receiving physical comfort, even from yourself. So what you'll need is just a comfy place to sit in. Directions. Sit in a comfortable chair or on a stack of big soft pillows and burrow in until your body feels just right in your cozy little nest. Now, wrap your arms around yourself and give yourself a gentle hug. Notice how it feels. If it's okay, rub your arms gently. Give yourself a pat on the back or stroke your hair. Say comforting things to yourself. Try to connect your gestures and words with being soothed and relax into them. It's fine if this exercise feels silly, strange, or makes you feel uncomfortable. Keep at it until the discomfort dissolves and you relax. You can pause to do this now. Reflection, to be done after the exercise. What was it like trying to physically soothe yourself? Did you connect with any comforting experiences from childhood, or did your attempt feel foreign or have negative associations? If your reaction was negative, try to understand why you might feel this way. You can pause the recording at this time to reflect on the lines provided on the handout. Why does food taste so good when I feel so bad? Let's face it, focusing on food is a grand distraction from our troubles. The very activities of searching through cupboards, shopping and cooking, chewing and swallowing, and cleaning up afterwards divert your attention away from what's going on inside you towards what you're doing. The mental effort of calculating calories and fat grams, wiping everything else off your slate. Not that you're necessarily aware of this diversion when you grab a snack when you're not hungry, or daydream about the fantastic life you'll have when you lose 10 pounds. Frankly, you're probably on autopilot. You may be thinking about food not because you're upset, but to prevent yourself from becoming upset. Vaguely aware of internal alarm, you hurry to shut off distressing sensations before they erupt into consciousness. If you're a dysfunctional eater who turns towards food when you're feeling bad, it tastes good in part because you're desperately looking for ways to ward off the blues, the blahs, and the jitters. How often do you continue to eat something that's flavorless, barely edible, or downright repulsive, like dry cereal, frozen donuts, stale crackers, a tub of butter, rancid leftovers, rather than experience your feelings? Let's face it. You wouldn't order any of these foods in a restaurant, but you tolerate them because a bad taste, any taste, beats a bad feeling any day of the week. Sometimes when you're swallowing is what you're swallowing is so horrid that it really is a toss-up. But too often, even when you're in doubt, food wins out. Another reason that food tastes so good for people who view it as panacea is that it's meant to be eaten so that our species will survive and flourish. Food is supposed to be appetizing and appealing, delectable and divine. So when you bite into a juicy apple or a buttery croissant, it's no surprise that your taste buds cheer wildly. You're happy even when you're not. But just because something tastes good doesn't mean you should be eating it, especially if the real business at hand is attending to emotions. Science has come a long way in understanding the complexities of appetite and effect. Research tells us that under stress, our bodies crave carbohydrates, which have chemical properties to soothe and relax us, just as milk did in infancy. Not only does food taste heavenly, it's also a source of what we're physiologically lacking in moments of distress. Take carbohydrates whose chemical compounds break down in our bodies in such a way as to calm and comfort us. Food does this job extremely well, too well. If you eat when you're in emotional distress, are you starting to see why you're what you're up against? Is it beginning to make sense why you're drawn toward yummy when you're feeling crummy? Pardon the rhyming. In spite of the fact that food is meant to nourish and be savored, if you're restrictive or rigid non-eater, you may use food to decrease or avoid emotional turmoil because of the act of saying no is such a huge chunk of effort and such validation is being in charge of your life. If you're feeling proud and elated about disciplining yourself to refuse food, there's very little room for upsetting emotion to squeeze into consciousness. Moreover, by rejecting food, you're putting your world back into balance as you offset internal agita with self-restraint. The very act of overpowering your innate hunger and craving for nourishment is a way of proving to yourself that you're strong and invulnerable. As you've learned, this is an exceedingly complicated subject that involves both body chemistry and early nurturing. Stop and feel. How does understanding the link between food and feeling lessen your shame about disordered eating? You can pause to reflect at this time on the lines provided on the handout. Is it ever okay to overeat or skip meals in response to disturbing feelings? There's nothing unusual or wrong with occasionally turning to or away from food or skipping meals when you're down and in the dumps or overwhelmed. It's all in your perspective, the way you think about food and its place in your life. Quote-unquote normal eaters may seek a lift in a candy bar or a cannoli, but they know that eating is no magical remedy for the downside of life. They recognize that food can be a savory treat, but will not solve ongoing problems. In fact, quote-unquote normal eaters may be terrible problem solvers, but the only thing they don't regularly do is feel better. To feel better is stuff themselves or habitually deny themselves nourishment in the pleasure of food. Moreover, even if they eat when they're frazzled, people who have a healthy relationship with food generally may remain at least minimally connected to their bodies and therefore stop eating when they're full or satisfied. They're just as likely to consume half of what they've chosen as they are to clean their plate. Whatever happens to the food once they're satisfied is of no concern to them. Of course, even people who are comfortable around food sometimes become so upset that they do disconnect from their bodies. What distinguishes them from people with eating problems is that this behavior isn't part of an everyday pattern. They don't beat themselves up, eat in secret, feel shame, or swear to eat differently tomorrow. Their self-concept, self-esteem, and general attitude have nothing to do with their behavior around food. Most importantly, they wouldn't spend the next half hour or an hour or a day and a half chastising themselves or use splurging on a treat as permission to go on a wild food binge. And they certainly wouldn't deprive themselves the next time they were hungry. If you asked what they did when they were distressed, they might not even remember that they'd enjoyed a bag of munchies or skipped an entire meal. They might have secondary emotions about what they were initially feeling, but not about what they'd eaten or not eating. Plus, they'd trust that their appetite would return to normal when emotional equilibrium returned. On the other hand, even quote-unquote normal eaters can truly lose their desire for food when hit with intense emotions. After a shock to the system, their appetite shuts down and the sight, thought, or smell of food may lose its appeal. Normal eaters do not intentionally deprive themselves of sustenance and nutrients as a way to cope. The response is automatic and unconscious, and except over an extended period of time, is not self-injurious. If this reaction only occurs occasionally, it's nothing to worry about. However, avoiding food on an ongoing basis is another story. If your conscious intent is to not eat because you think you'd get fat or won't get thin, or because eating makes you physically and emotionally uncomfortable, you're imposing an unhealthy restriction on your body. Moreover, you may have discovered that one of the best detours around your messy inner world is to shift from your heart to your head by refusing food. Instead of dealing with your life, you reminisce about a thinner past or fantasize about a skinnier future. Although it's absolutely fine to occasionally use a refuse food when you're feeling low, breaking out into a binge or going on a hunger strike on a regular basis is simply unhealthy. Your work is to trust that you'll gradually move towards eating more normally and only rarely eat or refuse food when you're upset, with absolutely no remorse. Which brings me to the subject of realistic expectations. The truth is, you're going to need a lot of practice to sever the connection between feeling and feeding. The good news is that you can practice all day long, every day, every time you're hungry or have a craving, every time you sense inner turmoil, and every time you start obsessing about food or weight. Each moment is a golden opportunity to work towards getting food and feeling right. Stop and feel. Are you worried that you'll never be able to choose feeling over dysfunctional eating? You can stop and reflect on the lines provided on the handout. Practice exercise. It's only food. The purpose of this exercise is to recognize, one, what it is about food that attracts and repels when you're in emotional discomfort, and two, how you confer upon food magical powers it doesn't have. Do this exercise only when you're feeling calm and relatively comfortable with yourself. The rationale behind this exercise is that most of us have strong feelings about food one way or another. Recognizing your visceral reactions is a great way to improve your relationship with eating and feeling. So, what you'll need is food that you're drawn to or repelled by when you're having emotional flare-ups. Directions. Place in front of you a food you usually eat or overeat, or alternatively, one that you intentionally avoid when you're upset. Notice how unmagical the food is, how it merely is a mix of ingredients. Pick it up, smell it, or even play with it. Focus on its composition. For example, eggs, sugar, wheat, flour, and write what you notice about it. Now, take a bite and notice how the food tastes and feels in your mouth. Concentrate on diffusing this food's power and write your reactions to your first bite, taking a slow second and third bite. Continue to write your reactions. You can use the lines provided on the handout to do so. Reflection, to be done after the exercise. What did you find magical about this food? What did you find ordinary? Exactly what does this food do for you when you're in emotional distress? What tells you that it really has no magic at all? You can pause to reflect on this question. How can I separate feeling from feeding? Part of the answer to this question takes us back to Chapter 1, The Function of Feelings, and how you know you feel emotional pain. If you're fairly accepting of and comfortable with feelings, you'll have an easier time than if you're almost entirely disconnected from them. The more disengaged you are, the earlier in the emotional process you'll have to sit up and take notice. People have varying accessibility to feelings. I've had clients whose typical response to being asked what they were feeling was an I don't know shrug, and others who could describe in a minute detail exactly what was going on inside of them. How well you separate feeling from feeding depends on where you are on the connected to feelings continuum. Stop and think how you describe yourself and how those you know well would describe you. Are you strongly in touch with feelings, moderately in touch, or out of touch? If you and your emotions rarely take a spin around the dance floor, you'll have to educate yourself about how your bodily sensations translate into emotions. What sensations indicate you're angry, lonely, sad, disappointed, frustrated, helpless, confused? Does each emotion feel the same in your body, or does each arise from a different physical sensation? The first step in disengaging appetite from affect is to translate bodily sensations to emotions. Start by paying specific attention to your breathing, pulse, and energy level. Notice if your chest feels hollow or fluttery. Your gut is tight knot, 100 butterflies are flittering around in your belly. Maybe your shoulders are tense, your fists or jaw are clenched, you're spacey or queasy, thoughts are racing around your head, or if there's a sense of dread in the pit of your stomach. Too often, we ignore physical manifestations of emotions rather than recognize them for what they are, messengers sending out a bulletin of what's going on inside us. Here are some examples. If every time you visit your friends, Leanne and Scott, they do nothing but bicker, you feel an unpleasant clenching in your stomach as you're about to ring their bell. If at the last minute you bow out of driving your best friend to the airport because you decide to sleep in, you may suffer a gnawing, nagging feeling that you did something wrong. If you're about to read a letter from the college you're dying to get into and your sister asks you a dumb question, you may feel disconnected from reality and not even hear her. These are all examples of physical reactions that accompany internal distress. Your response to danger is biologically programmed and of necessity highly attention-grabbing in order to keep you alive. When you perceive a threat, your senses automatically perk up, your breathing quickens, and blood flows to your heart, making it pound. The emotions you have when you're robbed at knife point are probably a good deal easier to identify than when you're feeling on a Saturday night with nothing to do. Antsy, mildly anxious, tired, empty, lonely, alienated, sad, bored. Some emotions broadcast themselves loud and clear, while others barely whisper, so you'll have to become very still and listen closely to what's going on inside your body to discover what emotions may be struggling to surface. You can't skip this process. If you want to disengage feeding from feeling, you'll have to experience the physical sensations that arise within you, no matter how uncomfortable. Let's dive into another practice exercise, physical manifestations of emotion. The purpose of this exercise is to connect physical sensations to emotions. and the rationale is that the best way to recognize if an emotion is stirring is to scan your body for physical sensations that you are feeling something deeply. And all you'll need for this exercise is painful memories. We all have them. Directions. Choose a disturbing incident that happened during the past week or one that's been haunting you for ages. Bring your feelings up about it into sharp focus. As if you're watching TV, turn up the volume and make sure the picture is clear and bright. Label what you're feeling. Dread, shock, rage, remorse, disappointment, powerless. Notice the sensations in your body that connect to this emotion. Also note what happens when you label what's going on, especially if the feeling worsens or eases up. Pay attention to what organs or body parts are in play and what's happening to them. Choose another feeling and go through the same process. You can pause now to do this. Reflection, to be done after the exercise. Were you able to identify the parts of your body holding your emotion? Do you usually pay attention to this kind of reaction, or do you ignore it? And what happened when you gave physical sensation the label of an emotion? You can pause to reflect on the lines provided on the handout. If you're feeling the least bit unskilled at connecting to body sensations that signal emotions, take heart. You have many chapters ahead of you to learn more about how internal commotion is channeled into an emotion. For now, simply pay attention to physical shifts which may indicate internal distress. The next step will be to fine-tune and become an expert at labeling emotions. This means distinguishing guilt from shame, anger from fear, helplessness from anxiety, and confusion from uncertainty. And then the final step, what to do with emotions, will be laid out in detail in the closing chapters of this workbook. For now, suffice it to say that you're on your way to developing a new set of skills or behaviors that will sure build and strengthen your emotional muscles. Further exploration. After each of the questions I read, take some time to pause and reflect on the lines provided on the handout. 1. What do you think makes the connection between food and feeling so strong for you? 2. How did your childhood experiences reinforce focusing on eating or not eating when you're emotionally uncomfortable? 3. Why is food even more comforting when you're upset? 4. Why might you turn away from hunger and cravings rather than nourish yourself? How would you describe the difference between how disordered and normal eaters use food when they're upset? 6. As you contemplate the idea of listening to both your feelings and your hunger, what tugs of resistance do you notice? 7. How do you feel about overcoming your emotional connection to food? Hopeful, hopeless, or mixed? 8. In general, how would you rate your connection to your feelings? Strong, moderate, poor, or non-existent? 9. What do you need to increase your connection to your emotions? 10. How can you improve at tuning into physical sensations that may be precursors to emotions? 5. Where do you imagine you are in the process of breaking the connection between food and feelings? Do you feel as if you're taking the first step? Do you feel like you may be halfway there? This completes this chapter of the reading. Feel free to review the materials as needed. Thank you for listening.